And good morning once again, and yes, another week has rolled around, it's Tuesday morning, and you're on the other side of midnight. That kind of magical time between dusk and dawn when the things we look at in daytime and say, ah, come on, that could never happen, when looked at this time of night, take on a totally different flavor and hue and possibility. We've got a really interesting show for you this morning. I'm not going to give it away yet, although you may have gone to the website and read some stuff. You can't always believe what you read on the web. Remember, as I said to Art many years ago, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. Let me start with politics. Oh, I know I can hear the streaks and the cries and the screams out there right now. This week on Wednesday night, there's going to be another amazing spectacle as part of this absolutely unbelievable and unprecedented, and, you know, one can't do enough about superlatives on this, election cycle. The CNN debate with all the Republican candidates is scheduled for Wednesday evening, which means on Thursday morning, we're going to be doing something having to do with that, at least in part. But what I wanted to tell you is, this is moving really at warp 9. Just a few days ago, people, critics, pundits were saying that Donald Trump didn't have a prayer, that he wasn't real, that he was, you know, a carnival act, whatever. Donald Trump is pulling 40% in New Hampshire, and Ben Carson is around 12. Bernie Sanders is doing astonishingly well. He's polling at 52% in New Hampshire, and Hillary is polling at 30. And the trend curve in Iowa is the same. The trend curve in other parts of the nation are the same. There is a phenomenon, folks, going on in our midst, right on our TV screens, in front of our eyes, and I intend, even though there are some screams out there when I say this, I intend to follow the politics, because, look, without politics, we ain't got nothing. Politics is the art of compromise where people of opposing views and opposing agendas and various, you know, private and self-interests in terms of the commons get together for the common good, and that's how we progress. At least that's how we used to progress. In the last few years, there's been this increasing, really insane polarization where nothing gets done. I mean, why do you think the Congress has a rating, you know, in terms of polls of something like 9%? That means that most of us think that they're bums, they should be thrown out, and we should start over or do something different. You know the old definition of insanity. If you do the same old thing, you're going to get the same old result, and you're nuts. Because unless you do something different, it's never going to change. Now, is Trump different? Is it going to be a significant difference? Is it actually going to help change the system back to what it needs to be? I don't know. Is Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side the same? I don't know. But I'm fascinated by this process because at the same time that we're seeing people throwing off the shackles of conventionality and ignoring the soap opera and focusing on what they want, which is something to work, we're also seeing the same phenomena appearing in other places overseas. There was just an election, as I said to one of my guests last week, regarding Britain's Labour Party, and they threw the bums out, and they've elected a really, really interesting guy who is not at all in the David Cameron mold, in fact, just the opposite. And what's even more interesting to me in terms of how this is breaking down, a la consciousness, as increasing consciousness, increasing perception, that we must do something different, we must get more involved, we must not accept the same old status quo, we must demand something new, something that works, something that's original, something where we all can come together in the commons for the common good of the United States of America. Okay, end of politics. So look, watch Wednesday night, then come here, you know, be here or be square, and we will take a look at it from the other side of midnight. Well, my guest this morning is Dave Dissler, as you may or may not remember, we had Dave on actually just about a month ago to talk about his work on something called the EM drive, or M drive. EM standing, of course, for electromagnetic radiation. Dave was born in Germany, as I noted before, and came to the U.S. as a naturalized citizen at the age of two. He grew up outside of Indianapolis, Indiana, and attended Purdue University in the early 70s, studying to become an airline pilot. When he left the university, he realized that the airlines had a surplus of pilots from Vietnam, so he went into electronics instead, and advanced through three major companies over 35 years in areas such as quality control, sales and marketing, and finally in product line management. In the military aerospace marketplace for these manufacturers, he obtained an extra class ham license, designed and built his own repeaters and controllers, became, this is a surprise, a genealogist. Maybe I should ask you about that this morning. Wrote three books and even helped produce a documentary in 2013. Dave and his wife Ellen currently reside in Ohio, have two grown kids, several cats, and a yard full of wildlife. He's currently semi-retired, and if he gets into the EM stuff, he's going to wind up very quickly unretired, and became interested in the drive after reading posts over on NASAspaceflight.com. Well, his curiosity led him to build his own design after months of research, and tonight Dave is back to tell us what's going on. He was going to be doing tests, that was a month ago. With bated breath, I asked the question, Dave, do we have a new access to space tonight or not?
Good morning, Richard. How are you doing?
Good morning, David.
Well, we have a more than likely chance that, yes, we do have something that we can tweak and get some use out of. It's still a lot of work ahead of us, but it's very, very promising from what I found out over the last month.
Wow. Okay, let us back up, because there are probably people who joined us who haven't a clue what we're talking about. If everyone goes, who has a smartphone, a tablet, a computer, any kind of device that can get you to the Internet, go to othersideofmidnight.com, click on Dave's name, which is in yellow there, which is carefully outlined it so it's easy to find. Click on his name. That will take you to Dave's page for tonight or this morning. And there you will see some images. And they're actually numbered, which is really useful. Ross is moving right along on that front, so we won't get lost. And above, you'll see two kind of, seems a shame to say, you know, in 15 years it's classic, but this is Roger Scheuer's EM drive configuration. The two images at the top, one and two. And then below that, three, four, and five are images that we grabbed from one of Dave's films, one of his videos of his test process. So I'll tell you what, why don't we start, Dave, with image number one, and you can kind of describe what we're looking at, how it works, and how your design either is the same or how it differs.
Sure, absolutely. The original unit that was designed by Mr. Scheuer was a very unusual, what I would consider to be like a bent cavity. It was something that a normal cavity, when you're dealing with the radio frequency, is basically a round cylinder. But as you can see, you know, the first image right there, something really weird about it. It looks like a nozzle. And that whole thing is filled with microwave radiation or electromagnetic radiation, however you want to say it.
You mean when you activate the wires and put current into the system?
When you put current into the system, yes. The feed for it, you know, where you're actually sending the signal into is, at least on the top picture there, is at the very top center, on kind of the upper right-hand side, there is a connector. There's two small rings, and it's actually fed from the side as opposed to the top. Mm-hmm. But that's where the radiation gets shot into it, And
so hold on. For those who are not seeing the images, othersideofmidnight.com, click on Dave's name. That will take you to his page, and then we're looking at the images at the top of his page. Number one, it's basically a cut-off copper cone with a cylindrical extension on the top of the cone. And apparently in Shire's model, that cone, that part of the cone could be moved back and forth to change the length of the cavity. Is that right?
That is correct.
And the idea is that you inject microwaves into this sealed copper cut-off cone, which is sealed on top and bottom. You put current in, you create microwaves that you beam in, and the microwave somehow in this sealed cone produces a thrust without throwing anything away.
That is correct. It's called propellantless drive or propellantless thrust, although it really does use energy, so it's not like a free energy machine. But the radiation itself, once it gets into this particular size and shape, starts to resonate, bounce around. No one quite understands, Richard, what what the theory is behind this. And there are some smart people out there working on it. There really are. There are all sorts of ideas. I've got my own idea. I don't have the math to prove it. But if you would look at the general shape of it, the first thing you would think of is a funnel and, the radiation bouncing around and then sort of starting to circulate into like a vortex.
Okay.
And so what's strange about the photons and radiation and this sort of thing is, you know, it's all operating at the speed of light. So as these photons start bouncing around and start aligning and start twisting, what happens as you're trying to compress the photons themselves at the speed of light, as they start circulating and twisting upon themselves, what's the magic that happens? Well, no one's got a formula for that right now.
Mm.
But that's sort of my thought, is something in there is happening. It's, let's say you can't go fast. Let's say it's impossible to go faster than the speed of light. But you're twisting and compressing these photons to the point that something's got to give. Well, what gives? If it doesn't go faster than light speed, then what happens? Is the mass of the photons displaced? Who knows? It's still, Richard, I would think that this is going to last for years. I don't think anybody's going to come up with anything in the next several months that's going to describe really what this propellantless drive really does. I think it's going to take years and years of study.
You mean in terms of a theory of how it works?
A theory of how it works, yes. Well, I think it's beyond us right now.
Well, according to Newton, this is impossible. This is why there's a lot of physicists and a lot of technicians and electronic folks and, you know, the people in aerospace that are used to working with engines and thrusters. You know, in any conventional rocket technology, you have a device that kind of looks like this, but it's open at one end, the big end.
That's correct.
You put fuel in the small end, you know, with oxygen. You ignite it with some kind of electronic spark or something. I mean, this is basically the shuttle engine, which we've seen a million times. And huge amounts of stuff flow out the big end, and the thrust pushes everything toward the small end. But, of course, you have a finite amount of fuel, so eventually your thrust stops. You know, your engine becomes dead weight because it no longer is useful. And in space, you coast and coast and coast until you wind up hitting something, which, depending upon the direction you're headed, could be millions of years, because the solar system is a very big place.
Mm-hmm.
This engine, if it works, and you put it in space and you turn it on, as long as you have a source of electrical power, be it the sun, you know, solar panels, or a nuclear, you know, reactor or whatever, it will just go and go and go and go and go. There's no moving parts. There's nothing to wear out. It basically can take you anywhere, as Heinlein said. You know, once you're in orbit, you're halfway to anywhere. Well, this is the other half of the half. And it would be a stunning revolution if it works.
Mm-hmm. We're hoping it does, a lot of us, although the way I'm approaching the experiment and the project is that I'm here to either prove or disprove what Scheuer has claimed, and also the Northwest Polytechnic Institute in China. They also claim that that they have developed thrust from this propellantless drive. There's been very, very little outside of those two and a small group that's working within NASA at the Johnson Space Center called the Eagle Works Laboratory. It's a group of, you know, a couple of three people, very, very underfunded. And
certainly by NASA standards. I mean, this is basically coffee money that NASA is spending on this.
And it's shocking to me. But then if you look at the classic way to get into space, and you know, the way Goddard did it back in the day, you know, just burn some propellant, or the Chinese for that matter, launching the fireworks. That's the way we've been doing it for centuries. And what is this crazy, you know, EM drive out there? And no one's going to believe us. We don't even have a theory on how it works. How much money can we afford to put into it? People will laugh at us. And so it's kept very, very low level. And that's maintained over the last month, very low profile within NASA. Not a word about it. Is supposedly some papers that are supposed to be written before the end of the year.
There's some conference coming up this fall, isn't there?
There is. There's several conferences. But by the end of the year, from what I've been told, is there is supposed to be a some sort of declaration of where the project is with Eagle Works. We had, I think the last time we were on, we had a German scientist, Tajmar, who had written a paper and delivered a paper down to a conference in Tampa, and I read his paper, and he's seeing that there's something unusual going on as well. We're right on the, I guess we're all on the edge of proving this thing, and I think before the end of the year, with, of course, I have a very modest home budget and everything, but before the end of the year, we're going to find out if this thing is real or not. If it's real, then just like you said, Richard, we can go anywhere and do whatever we want to. As long as we've got electricity that we can convert into electromagnetic radiation, we can go across the solar system and galaxy and so forth.
See, what's so stunning to me, I asked you before we got on the air if you'd heard our show on Saturday morning, and you said you hadn't. There is an archive, and I would recommend that you go take a listen, because what we talked about is the stunning stuff found by NASA on Ceres and on Pluto with the two missions, the Dawn mission and the New Horizons mission. The New Horizons mission with chemical propellants and coasting all the way, except for the first few frantic seconds in the very beginning, took 10 years to get to Pluto. 10 years. If this drive works, as you know, Dave, even if it only works at a level of a few ounces of thrust, and you're thrusting against a spacecraft with cameras and sensors and infrared and all that kind of stuff to get you really good data when you get somewhere, we could take a commercial spacecraft. We could buy for a few million bucks a commercial spacecraft off the shelf from Lockheed Martin or from Musk, you know, or one of these guys, put it into space, get it into Earth orbit, light up the EM drive, and with an appropriate source of electricity, we could get that spacecraft to Pluto in a matter of weeks, even if it only had a thrust level of a few ounces, because in zero gravity, you just keep thrusting and thrusting, and the speed is building and building and building. It's like in that original prototype pilot for Star Trek, when Sulu is asked about, you know, some technology or whatever, and he says it's kind of like, you know, adding a penny. If you add a penny every day, 2 pennies, 4 pennies, 8 pennies, 16 pennies, 32 pennies, eventually you can be a millionaire. Well, in space, even a tiny amount of thrust, if you have unlimited time and unlimited power, and solar cells are cheap and they're available from almost anybody now, you can do astonishing things, which is why I'm so intrigued with your experiments, because you're the first guy, Dave, that we've got our hands on who's built one of these things, and tonight you're going to tell us what you found. So let's go back to your build. Let's now look, at image number 3? Why don't you tell us how you started to assemble this and what you had to do to get to where we're going to be eventually talking about tonight?
Sure. Image number 3, and for those who aren't on the website, basically the cone itself is sealed at the top and bottom.
Now you have it oriented here in a down position. In other words,
in a down position, the
small end is facing mm-hmm. the floor,
right?
And the big end is facing up, and both ends are mm-hmm. sealed. Mm-hmm. And is this made of copper?
Yes, it is. It's 100% copper. Now the sides of the cone are actually a mesh.
But it almost exactly. It looks like I can see through it. So it must be like a screen, a copper mm-hmm. window screen, very fine
it
mesh.
It is. It is. It's 99% copper. It's a very fine screen. In other words, the holes are very small, and the radiation looks at the copper mesh as a solid part. It doesn't leak out of the side of the cone.
Well, it's like when you look through the window, through the door on a microwave oven. Even though you can look in to see your food, there's a mesh inside the glass. And the mesh doesn't let the microwaves of that wavelength come out and kill you.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct.
So what are you using for a microwave source for this experiment?
It's simply what you have in your average, everyday kitchen microwave. It's called a magnetron. Been around for many, many years, since back in the 40s. It's been upgraded and mass-produced and downsized, and basically it's the size of, you hold it in the palm of your hand, weighs maybe, I don't know, I'd say about 800 grams or so, and it's
Dave,
it's,
Dave, we're in America. How many pounds, how many ounces?
Come on. grams to ounces. There
right, you while
go.
While you're doing that conversion, let me say one thing. Mm-hmm. Do not take apart your microwave, folks out there in Radio Land tonight. Do not hold it in your hand. For God's sake, don't turn the damn thing on because you will kill yourself. This is an experiment that can be very, very dangerous. So only professionals, only people that know electronics, microwaves, and high voltage. I mean, the high voltage alone would give you a heart attack in a heartbeat. So do not do this at home unless you really, really know what you're doing.
That's a good point. And that's one thing that that I wanted to talk a little bit about tonight, maybe before we start answering some questions from your callers, is it used to be, Richard, that people like me were fairly run-of-the-mill as far as people who are willing to build things and put things together. It used to be that you could order a bag of parts and put together a radio receiver. About a long time ago, back in the day when you'd make these little crystal radios, these little kits.
Are we talking Collins radio?
Collins is actually a completed assembly that was made by Rockwell. Well, they're known as Rockwell Collins now, but no, this is more Heathkit. This is more like a shortwave receiver.
Okay.
That you would put together, and it really was a kit. You would solder all the resistors and capacitors together, and you would build it yourself.
My uncle did that.
Yes.
And because he's no longer with us, I can now tell a story on the air that I've never told anyone before. Uh-huh. When he left the shop, I was so curious. I was like, 10, 11? I took a kitchen table knife, and I stuck it into his build. And he comes back, and he sees this smoking thing, and he looks at me, and he looks at it, and he says, "Oh, you're still alive." Never did that again.
No. In fact, you were probably worried. You weren't worried about the electrocution. You were worried about him coming over, chasing you, messing up his build. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
But, you know, today is a I don't know if we mentioned that about a month ago or not, but it's a plug and electronics, anyway, to me, have been a plug and play and throwaway type of world. There's not a lot of builders out there, although...
Let me stop you there. The thing that impressed... about the NASAspaceflight.com forum that's discussing the equations and the relativity. There's an awful lot of people like you, Dave, who actually just wanted to get their hands dirty and were dying to build one of these things to see if it worked. To me, that's democracy in action. Why wait for NASA when you can do it yourself if you know what you're doing?
Well, that's true, and that was exactly the way it was for me. Why wait for them to come out again? Because as this project drive was described, there wasn't anything that I hadn't worked around before. The high voltage as well as the RF and the material itself. I worked around all of it, but never in this configuration, which is what got my interest. But here I was waiting for NASA, and you know how long that can take sometimes with information. So why wait? And there are a pocket of people out there that are getting involved. Something called, what's the term? Citizen science. All of a sudden, that's a term that I might introduce to you and your audience. In the last few months, as a matter of fact, I've done a little bit of a study on that, and that's where it's taking, a citizen scientist is somebody who just has an interest in something, and they're taking it upon themselves to learn, read up, study, put together their own, small, humble lab, and do their own experiments rather than waiting for someone else to do it. Now, it's not just in electronics, it's in things like environmental science and that sort of thing. So there's a movement going on. So I think slowly we're getting back into the fact that we're participating in the scientific and discovery process.
Which with the rise of social media, I kind of wonder why there's been this lag, because obviously, remember years ago there used to be a commercial, "Mother, I want to do it myself."
Mm-hmm.
People are tired of waiting for government. I mean, look at the Trump thing. Look at Bernie Sanders. Look at what's going on in the political process. I am so thrilled that there are people like you who have decided we're not going to wait for government. We're going to do it ourselves, and damn it, it either works or it doesn't, and then we will move on.
That's exactly what you just nailed it right there, exactly how I feel.
Terrific. So look, we are coming to the bottom of the hour. I'm going to do something special tonight. People toss us music. Over and over and over again. Tonight I'm going to play a tune from one of our listeners, a guy named Bob Bright. And what Bob Bright has done is he has actually taken the theme from our program, The Other Side of Midnight, and he has written a song. So without further ado, let's listen to what Bob Bright has to sing. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back. My guest this morning is Dave Distler, and the program you're on is The Other Side of Midnight, and we shall return. Bob Wright, The Other Side of Midnight. And good morning once again. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. You are on the other side of midnight. And my friend this morning and my guest this morning is Dave Distler, who is rapidly becoming my friend because he's going to give us access to the solar system. Dave, continue.
Thank you very much. And hey, congratulations to, I believe you said it was Bob out there that put together a some music for the show. Sounded really good, by the way.
He just, his voice levels need to be a little higher and the music a little lower, but I thought, you know, look, anybody who has the guts to write something, compose it, you know, produce it, and then send it, I'll play it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good job. That's, I thought that was really good. Where we're at is I've had what I call three flight tests on this thing.
No, don't tell me it lifted off the kitchen floor. Come on, don't.
No, not quite. Well, actually, it did. There were on the three tests that I made. Let's see. Looks like if you jump down past just the pictures 3, 4, and 5.
Okay.
There is flight tests that I did August the 29th.
Okay, so now this is the first of the video. It's it's the number 6. You click on that.
Click on that. What happens is you're going to see, you're not going to see the assembly or the test stand or the balance beam, whatever you want to call it. What you're going to see is a displacement of a laser pointer as it starts moving up and down. And it does have some very curious responses as the system fires up.
And that's you in the background describing it. All right, let me
describing
knock that down.
What's going on. And it's a little boring because what it is it's just a picture of, like I say, just the laser spot as the magnetron fires up and sort of starts moving in a certain direction and settles back down.
Have you ever seen the pictures of mesons in a cloud chamber?
Yes, I have, as a matter of fact. Yeah.
I mean, most people would say they're boring, but they're the cutting edge of relativity. That's
right.
How relativity was proven, in part, because mesons that are produced by cosmic rays in the upper atmosphere should not be able to, in terms of their tiny, 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 tiny lifetimes, even get down to the surface of the Earth, 80, 100 miles down, and yet they do. You can record them in the cloud chamber with taking a photograph of, you know, atomic particle tracks in this chamber, which is basically produces condensation when the particles zip through it, and they show these little, like almost like little mini contrails. That is what we're looking at on this video. It's not boring at all, because if it works, Dave, this is history.
It is, and what I've discovered here is that the bulk of the movement that I have seen.
Hang on. Back up and tell us what you're doing. So we have the picture of your frustum, your conical copper mesh cone cut off top and bottom, oriented down. You got the microwave magnetron feeding microwaves into it. You turn on the power, and you got this thing on what, a little teeter-totter so that it can change angle and balance? And then you got a laser pointer aimed at the wall across the room.
It actually bounces off of a mirror and then to a laser target. The total run of is about 38 feet from where the laser pointer starts to where it winds up on the laser target.
So you turn the power on, and as Galileo said, it moved.
It does move.
Wow.
It does move. No doubt about it. It does some very strange things. Most of it.
We love strange things over here.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. Most of it is due to an almost instant lift that's due to the heating of the air. It's called a thermal lift. It's almost like a balloon effect. And what it does is it almost instantaneously converts all of the moisturized air that's within that frustum. And the reason I designed it with the screen is to let that air go out, you know, so it's not just like a solid copper balloon. And it starts to rise in the opposite direction of where the thrust is supposed to go. So and the force itself is rather significant. Again, I'm going to get into the scientific terms of let's say the magnetron weighs 700 milligrams. The weight of the force is about 250, or the lift is about 250 milligrams. So it's not enough for it to lift itself up, but it's a fairly substantial amount of lift. But before it gets into...
This is from the ballooning effect.
The ballooning effect.
You're basically creating a hot air balloon with a transparent mesh to the air.
Yep.
And when you turn the microwaves on, I mean, how many watts are we talking about? 1,000, 2,000 watts?
900.
900, just under 1,000.
Just under 1,000, yes.
So mm-hmm. when you turn it on, you're heating the air in this copper cone, and the air basically creates a buoyancy. Mm-hmm. So that the force in the surrounding air is to lift it up, but you got it oriented so the actual force of the drive, if there's a force from the drive, the drive would be pointing down so that the force would be counter to the lifting properties of the heated air.
Yes, and it wants to resist it. What's really strange is that it. You can tell that it's wanting to not do it. In other words, there's
nothing. Not do what?
Lift. It's wanting to go the opposite direction.
Oh.
It does want to start in that direction, but then the buoyancy takes over.
Oh, so you can actually see this in the graphs?
In the graphs, yeah. You can see it in the graphs. It starts oscillating or resonating, is what it's called. I haven't been able to get the resonance to lock it. I haven't been able it to get synced up. And of course, you know, just really working on it for the past 3 months, it's obviously going to take me longer, but I can see that it wants to lock in, and it wants to go against the buoyancy, but the buoyancy is so strong, and that's maybe where some of the previous people have been fooled a little bit. But the buoyancy is much, much stronger than whatever the thrust factor is. But of course, in space, Yeah, no problem. Go ahead.
You need to find a vacuum chamber.
I will need to find a vacuum chamber. Once I get this thing to where I'm satisfied with its, it is producing something against the buoyancy, I'll take it. Now, fortunately, I live about 30 miles away from NASA Glenn, and they've got a huge vacuum chamber, enough to easily test this thing. So I do have a couple of friends that... that work over there, and if I can provide enough data, I think, to them, and I can give them enough time, I wouldn't doubt that they would see fit that I could, get in there and maybe do, a 30-minute test or something. I've got high hopes for that, but that's the only way, because obviously you're not going to have that buoyancy in space. Even if you have just a little bit of thrust. And by the way, I didn't catch the show on Saturday morning, but I've been following very closely the stuff going on with Ceres. Can you imagine being able to go there really quick and say, wait a minute, no one expected to see what they're seeing right there.
Yes.
And the closer they get, the stranger the things look there.
See, this is so mind-boggling, because if your device works as proof of principle, and we'll get back to the technology in a moment, then scaling it up with off-the-shelf Radio Shack parts and marrying the project with some of the major guys who are doing real spacecraft engineering. I mean, there's a whole group of hams that operate out of Goddard. I'm sure you're aware of those.
Yes.
And they've actually built spacecraft that NASA has then launched into space. So we've got a huge fund of talent that could put together a spacecraft and the engine and the power supply. We could have our own private enterprise, like that word, mission to Ceres in a couple years.
Mm-hmm. And see what the heck's going on there, because it is, the closer they get, the stranger it looks.
You've got to listen to Saturday morning show.
I joined after our last conversation. I joined. It's very, very reasonable. And I have been listening to prior shows. I just have been tied up the last couple of three days and haven't had a chance to go back to the archives. But, oh, yeah, I've listened to several of the shows. And it's a reasonable pricing for it. And, yeah, I'm a member.
Thank you for the promo.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, look, if this works, everything we said Saturday morning is like cubed or to the factor of 1,000 or whatever. we can actually check this out ourselves. So let's go back to your test. So you got this on the little balance beam. You got the laser pointing on a mirror, bouncing across the wall, so you get magnified motion. You turn it on. The buoyancy effects want to make it rise, but the drive effects, something going on inside in the microwave interaction with the ether, the torsion field, whatever, it wants to drive it into the floor of your kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how much thrust were you actually getting? Did you were able to calculate that?
It is less than one-tenth of what the rise is. In other words, if I'm just using round numbers here, but let's say there's a lift of around 200 milligrams, a thermal lift, a buoyancy.
How many ounces would that
want to call
be?
It. Richard, now you're killing me. Okay, let me get to my conversion table. I'm so used to these the scientific terms here,
and
but
most people
it's
are.
One-tenth of that. So 200 milligrams of lift, there's about 20 milligrams or less of what I consider to be opposite effect or thrust,
okay.
If you want to call it thrust.
Okay, so if we get rid of the ballooning buoyancy effect, you'd have a pure thrust measurement. But mm-hmm. You actually got the setup where you can actually separate the two phenomena because they're basically in opposite directions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one-tenth of the buoyancy. Well, 200 milligrams, it's like what, maybe an ounce?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that?
It's close. I've got a really good conversion table that I use here.
The point is, while you're doing that, an ounce of thrust continuous forever, as long as your power lasts, in space, will take you to the stars. You're not even limited to the solar system. You know, it's like, head out there, third star on the left, that thing.
It exactly right. We are stuck in LEO, and what LEO means is a low Earth orbit, and we have been stuck there
since Apollo.
Yeah, since Apollo, and we haven't. I don't care what they say. In general, other than the probes that the unmanned probes, as far as you and me, people, we're LEO. We've been LEO ever since. I mean, there was the moon missions, which was a very short, relatively speaking, time there and back. But we've lived in low Earth orbit for far too long. And I'm getting to the point where I think one of the things that's driving me on this thing is that all we're ever meant to do?
Mm.
You know, so...
Well, this is a get-out-of-jail-free card.
This is. Well, let's put it this way. 200 milligrams is 0.007 ounces.
Okay.
So we're talking about a very, very light light thrust. But it doesn't really matter if it's constant and you've got somebody slowly pushing, even with a fraction, a few tenths of an ounce, pushing at your back forever, how fast will you go in 2 months?
Well, how much thrust does the Dawn spacecraft ion engine produce?
The ion engine is actually not much... not much more than that.
No.
It's not a lot.
It takes a humongous amount of power.
Yes, it does.
Whereas this is really, really incredibly efficient conversion.
Mm-hmm.
No moving parts, nothing mm-hmm. to throw away. You have to carry fuel. Xenon is the fuel for some ion engines. This is all self-contained. And if you want more thrust, there are situations where you might want more thrust, you make them in clusters. You gang them together.
Correct. You would put these together, and I've seen some really good illustrations of that, to where it's in a ladder formation. You have a row of these thrusters, a whole line of them above and below, so it looks like a long, basically a ladder, above and below, that's could
like
be
a
100
like,
feet in
length. Or like a light bar, where you'd have these engines clustered down the light bar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lots of ways to do it. I'll tell you what, it's going to be very, very interesting over the next several weeks. I have found out that to separate the only thing that I've learned in the last month is you've really got to move. You got to look at it a lot tighter, a lot closer. So I've had to go off and get some laboratory equipment. It's become a bit of a challenge to separate out, because of the small amounts of weight. A laser pointer on a balance beam is just not going to give me the resolution to where I can say, yes, okay, we have exactly 18 milligrams of thrust. So I've gone out and got a what's called a laser displacement sensor. And what that does is that actually...
That sounds cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. It's a... Yeah, well, let's say your factory that you're producing makes pistons, and one of your operators machines these pistons out, and at the end of the day, he's got 150 pistons for a car. Well, you put the pistons on a lathe, and you spin it around to make sure that it's nice and round, and there's no variation in the circular shape. Well, they measure that with what's called a laser displacement sensor. They shoot a little laser beam at these pistons or whatever part happens to be turning or sliding across it, and it measures it like a micrometer, like a mechanical micrometer. It sort of shoots out the laser, bounces back, and that's actually, I got one of those. I got an old pullout from a manufacturing plant that had closed, and I can measure now. I'm getting it all set up as we speak, but I can measure displacement of that beam down to micrometer level. So,
oh, wow.
I'm going to be able to see an instantaneous change. And see, the reason I'm interested in that is I want to see exactly how much is trying to fight against that lift. Because really, I don't have a vacuum at my house. I mean, there's you know, I've got a vacuum cleaner, but I don't have a vacuum chamber. So there's no way I can really... that I have to live, just like we're living in low Earth orbit, I have to live with the fact that, you know, I'm going to have to deal with thermal lift. So I've got to characterize it, and I've got to separate out thrust from that.
Okay, hang on a sec. If when you turn the power on, there's a time lag between the air heating and the thrust, and there was a thrust to be instantaneous pointing down, but the heating of the air should lag because it takes a little while, I don't know, a second or two, maybe to heat the air to where it's giving you lift. So if you could measure in that time interval before the buoyancy takes over, you could get an accurate measurement of how much thrust for how much power.
That's correct. And even though I've not been able to get it to lock in, to actually have that thrust just lock in yet, I say yet because I feel that I'll be able to get really close to that, is just for that few milliseconds before the lift kicks in there. I want to see what's going on with this thing. I want to see why I'm getting these like vibrations, like it is wanting to fight against this ballooning effect. And so you start looking at the experiment starts out and you know, you put your hands way far apart and you start narrowing things down. Your hands get close together. You see what I'm saying? It's mm-hmm. I'm trying to illustrate that you have to start looking at the very, very small detail.
The devil is in
the
we
details.
All know.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So that's something that has been very interesting for me to really get back involved like this, because you start out with a big picture and you start analyzing down and down and down, and before I can say yes, this thing works, let's launch this into space, I want to actually characterize and see this thing with its thrust effect you know, taking over and actually maybe locking in. Now I don't think I'll ever be able to have it fight the buoyancy. I just don't think so, but I don't have to. And just like you said, you don't have to. If you can generate this thing and you can lock it in and it's providing thrust, then the slightest amount, string them together, gang them together, make them in a big long ladder shape. You can make them in a big circular spiral pattern, whatever. Let's get this thing out to Ceres and let's land, send down a lander and find out what the heck's going on down there, because that is definitely some interesting stuff. But what, we have to wait another 5-10 years before they send something else up conventionally? Probably.
Probably. So let's not wait for them to do what they're doing conventionally. This is mind-boggling, Dave. This is really amazing. Because what you can do now with this test setup is you can vary parameters. Like, I noticed that your cone is rather shallow.
Mm-hmm.
Can you easily create a steeper cone and see if that changes the efficiency? Because obviously you're pumping almost 1,000 watts of energy in, and you're getting 0.00-something ounces out. Is there a way to increase the thrust?
Yes, you do change the shape. Now, easily, no, but can be done, yes. If there's lots of discussion out there amongst a lot of my compadres on NASA space flight about, you know, the shape of the cone, the length of the cone, the material that the cone's made up of, the types of signals that you send into it, like magnetrons. They spray out a range of frequencies. Well, a lot of people are
I think it's Skype again.
Yeah, Gabe? Are you still?
Yeah,
I'm still here.
Yeah. Skype cuts out every once in a while. It's weird.
Yeah, you know, I had trouble. I was using my cell phone the last time on Wi-Fi, and it cut out. And every once in a while, but you can hear me okay now?
Yep, fine.
Okay. So yeah, there's lots of ways to go. If you actually were on the forum and you were reading, and it's very you know, there's PhDs on there, there's engineers, there's lay people like myself. I consider myself a lay person when it comes to some of these discussions on relativity and physics, but they can give you so many different ideas and so many different ways to go if you follow the forum, and you would come up with 1,000 different designs. So, just like my friend Michelle on NSF has done, she listened to a lot of different. But she did focus in on the way she wants to do it. So she's found a design that she prefers, and I had one here, and then we're going with that. We're pushing that one to the maximum. We're going to do as best we can with it. She's several weeks or months away from her experiment. But
is this the gal that likes to sit in the hot tub and think?
That is her. That is her. And I'll tell you, that's the best way to think.
Not with high voltage, it isn't.
No, as long as the electronics are across the yard, you're in good shape.
So she's how far away from her tests?
Weeks or months, I would say. Now her test stand has come together pretty well. She has got a very nice test facility that she's putting together in a fairly good sized garage, and I was joking with her the other day that we might have to make that the international flight test proving grounds for the M drive, and everybody that comes up with a working model, they think is a working model, should go to her test stand. She's got Faraday cages, which are basically radiation shields, around the balance beam. She's quite an engineer.
So she's really put together a complicated system that will hopefully eliminate some of these extraneous factors.
That is correct. She can't create a vacuum. So she's been watching my experiment carefully. She cannot create a vacuum at her location, so she's going to have to follow suit on what I'm going through right as we kind of speak about separating out the thermal lift from the thrust result.
So is her device also a mesh so that the hot air escapes?
Hers is a little different, and that's one thing that's kind of interesting because everybody's trying something a little different to see what works and what doesn't. Hers is actually a solid sidewall, but it's actually drilled holes. So it's very small perforations in it, but rather than a mesh, most of it is solid copper.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Shower's design that you see there, or some of your listeners can look at on the website, his is just all solid. But both Michelle and myself felt that, you know, we need to get some of this heat out of the cone somehow. I decided mesh, and she decided just perforating copper, solid copper. So both of those things actually do result in the same thing. But, you know, even with that mesh, Richard, I got to tell you, I was really surprised because technically that air should be sliding out of that mesh awfully
well,
fast.
Well, yeah, because it's basically transparent to air.
I know it doesn't. The thermal rise on the thermal lift on that. You know, if I didn't know better, and I just fired this thing up, I'd consider it anti-gravity because I wouldn't understand why the thing was lifting up. But it's not. It's thermal lift. But it, I'm surprised about the amount of it, to tell you the truth.
Well, apparently heating air with 1,000 watts is very effective at heating air.
Yes, well, get 10 100-watt light bulbs and put your hand over the top of it, and you'll see pretty quick. Or I guess you can get yourself a 250-watt light bulb to do the same thing. So
okay, for the folks that want to follow the other guys doing all this, if you go to nasaspaceflight.com, that's www.nasaspaceflight.com, there's actually a link at the bottom of Dave's little bio on othersideofmidnight.com tonight. You can find this whole conversation. It's incredibly technical at times. It's also incredibly human. There's Michelle in the hot tub, which is not the kind of engineering I was ever taught. But this is the cutting edge of a stunning revolution, Dave. I mean, you apparently... All right, why don't you take us back through more of the videos, because obviously you did some other tests.
Right, I did some other tests, and I've actually got a... on a YouTube site there, it's NSF-1701 electromagnetic experiment. And I think if you just select one of those two that you show listed there, it'll link back to the page. But the other pages were just basically showing, you know, how I was putting together the drive, what the frustum looks like. I put it together with common household ladders and vices and knife edges and hardwood balance beams and all sorts of things. Just a lot of stuff I had laying around. But as I've gotten deeper and deeper into the testing of this, I am going to have to start getting some laboratory equipment, and that's where a lot of the challenge has been right now, is to getting a lab standard set up. But I'm slowly able to. I set up a little PayPal donation site for people who wanted to help me with it, and that has offset a lot of the costs. Because once you start getting the precision lab equipment in, like that laser displacement sensor, that you're starting to get some dollars involved in that type of thing. So,
okay, we'll hold it there. We'll be right back. We are going to take a short break. This morning, we're featuring submissions from our audience. This one that I'm going to play you now as we go into the break is not from one of our audience. It's from an old friend of mine, Victoria Keating, who I met at one of Stephen Bassett's conferences that I spoke at some years ago in D.C. This one is called, appropriate to where we'd like Dave's AM drive to take us, it's called Pluto, Pluto, Pluto. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we will return.
Turning to stone. You lost what you love when you love no more, and now I'm the one, I don't care anymore. Under the ground, there's room for the poor. I'm under the earth, I'm deep in the core. Pluto, Pluto, go deep, go slow. Nothing else can get to you like you can get to you.
And we are back. You are on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Dave Distler, and we're discussing a revolution. Dave, do you really think you're seeing thrust, or are we looking at a kind of a bobbing effect where the air gets heated, it's released, more air comes in and kind of bubbles so that it goes boing, boing, boing? Or are we really certain, and if we are certain, how are you certain that this thing wants to basically go to the Earth's core?
That is the it used to be called $1,000 question. It should be like $64 billion question right now. I guess I can't answer that in pure scientific terms. If I was putting on my scientific hat, I would probably have to say that I couldn't tell you 100% for certain. I could certainly tell you that I feel that it's worth pursuing from what I have seen. There is a more than 50-50 chance that I am seeing something that isn't just some sort of bubbling or gurgling of the air itself. It was pretty clear the resonance that started. The secret is being able to, to maintain that. And we're looking at such fine movement, small movement, I guess is what I should say. That's why I had to go out and get some of the lab gear, because I'm looking at a very short period of time, very small amount of force. And if I can actually see this stair step, you know, the magnetron on, that's when it starts moving down, and it's fighting against the lift. Another thing is the test I'll be running, obviously, I can set up a warm-up period. I'll be able to determine, for example, how much lift can I ever get out of this thing. Let's say that it's 250 milligrams of lift, and that's as much as it'll ever do. Well, that's when I can start doing my test measurements on downward thrust. So let's say 250 milligrams is as much lift as it'll ever come out of this 900-watt system. Mm-hmm. Well, then I can start measuring there. Okay, I'm going to heat this thing up until it can't go any higher, and then start looking at pulsing it with the magnetron and see what happens from there. So,
all right, given that the thrust is dependent on the microwaves, but the heating is just dependent on heating. The heated air is just heated air. Mm-hmm. What if you were to replace the magnetron with a 1,000-watt floodlight in the chamber and do the measurements with just a heat source producing no microwaves?
That's correct. That's a very good way to do it. You can have a heat source within it. You can have one underneath it. You can have an opposite. You could build if I had unlimited funds and unlimited time, I could build another duplicate on the opposite side.
Well, let's stop there. How much money do you need, and can the Other Side of Midnight audience help? Because this is a revolution. What can we do to help?
Well, support, I think,
don't
is the
shy.
Number one.
Don't be shy. Come on.
Well, there isn't. If you went out and bought, just for example, the laser displacement sensor equipment itself, you're looking at about $800. If you found one that was, was in really good shape and all that. So I've had to scrape and save. We're talking basically in the thousands, less than 5,000, but certainly in the thousands of dollars to really get this thing going. There's really only one way. I didn't create a special GoFundMe site. There's a lot of things that you could do now, like Kickstarter and GoFundMe. It's just simply a little PayPal donation site where people can put a dollar, or as some people have put already, I've had one or two people dropped in $100.
Cool.
And that has gone a long way. I've got I didn't tell your producer the site name, if you would like for me to do that,
absolutely, go for it.
Our
job here, Dave, is to help. This is a revolution. You're proceeding scientifically. This audience wants to get off the earth. They'd like to go and check out what's really out there and not have NASA tell them nothing to see. Move along. So where can we help?
You can go to www.paypal.me. In other words, it's paypal.me.
Oh, so me is not Dave Disler. Me is M-E.
Yeah, it is M-E. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
/NSF1701. And NSF is Nancy Sam Frank 1701.
And, that's a familiar number.
Yes.
Come
exactly.
on, Dave. Tell us what the number means.
Yeah, I kind of gave away my age there tonight. I think NSF is in capital letters, but you might be able to put that in small letters. But paypal.me/NSF1701, and it's just a picture of my face, and I get tired of looking at that. But anyway, there it is, and it doesn't say anything. It just says send money to Dave. It is for specifically 1701. The NSF 1701 project doesn't go anywhere else. I buy lab equipment when I get donations. I've always put, of course, my own time and money into it as well. But if your audience can help, I would be tremendously appreciative. And you can only do so much with common household items. I mean, I've tried really hard. In fact, by the videos, you can probably see, I've tried to use every common thing I could that I had around the house. I didn't have to go out and buy specifically for it. And that's been kind of fun. That's been a challenge because I try to do it as low budget as possible. And, you know, it kind of takes me back to the old days when I used to watch a neighbor when I was a kid. My neighbor used to put together just the weirdest contraptions and things, and I just marveled at what he was able to make out of nothing. And that's what kind of got me involved in electronics and things like that. But we need to get our hands back in. We need to roll up our own sleeves, not wait for the government or some of these private institutions. Like, you know, we were talking earlier about that polytechnic, that military college in China that said that they have measured thrust like Scheuer has. They're military, and they're not going to be telling anybody what's going on. They put together a paper, put the paper out, and then that's the last anybody's heard of them, and probably will forever. So there is a very limited amount of official channels that this whole technology is.
Given the size of this audience, if people just kicked in, you know, 50 cents to, you know, choose a ridiculously small number, you'd be funded tomorrow.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this isn't something that you have to throw down big bucks. If everybody puts it in a little bit, then it can go to the next level. I do plan to follow this thing through in 5 months. If I am not able to, and I will do this. If I'm not able to say, "Yep, I have got something here. It's proven. I've got it documented. I've got it videoed. I've got the." DAQ data, the data acquisition data, and here's the run, here's the tabular data, then I'm not going to say that it works, but there's lots more to do. The more you get into it, the more you get into it, let's put it that way. I'm going to do it smart, I'm going to do it economic, and I'm going to do it on a home budget, and I hope that it kind of stimulates others out there, this citizen scientist movement that seems to be going on the last several years. I think your audience can pick up on that, whether it's electronics or environmental concerns or thoughts, or if they just get their own hands into something, if they don't wait for somebody else to do something. I think it's kind of the message that I'm rediscovering. I guess I always knew it, but you forget stuff like this if you don't actually get involved. But get involved in something. Find yourself something that really interests you, even if it's things like the paranormal or anything. It could be anything. Put some science behind it to test out, whether or not what somebody tells you works or doesn't work. Challenge the people that say that they're doing something that works. Well, you know, maybe I'm going to prove it myself that it doesn't work. Get out there and do it. It's not that difficult. Of course, there's not a Radio Shack on every corner like there used to be. So
no, there aren't. Let's give out the website so people can fund you. Give it out one more time. Okay. And Rich, please take this down. Let's put it on Dave's page so that anyone who comes back to this from the archives can actually just log on to othersideofmidnight.com, Dave Dissler's page, and there is the link for funding this extraordinarily crucial experiment. Dave, I cannot overstate how critical this experiment is, because it's the kind of thing where we get instant feedback with the web, with the net. You're obviously posting results. You've got videos. You've got measurements. I presume there are graphs. You're obviously going to be changing and updating with what's going on. So if people want to be involved in basically kickstarting a revolution to get us off the planet, this, to me, tonight looks really, really the way we should go.
I think we have to get away from the rocket era, and this is one way that it very well may permit us to do that. I'm very hopeful that it will. I'm pursuing it I'm pursuing it with an open mind, but I'm encouraged by the amount of time I've spent researching it and building it, and I believe there's something to it. It's worth pursuing. But yeah, the website is simply www.paypal.me/NSF1701.
And of course, the 1701, for those who are still not getting it, is the enterprise number.
That is the enterprise number, and my tip of the hat for NSF is the NASA Space Flight Forum, where I got my first introduction into what the heck this thing was all about, and some great people there. You know, and there's people there that are skeptics as well as believers, and everybody seems to get along. Everybody is, you know, if someone throws something out there that's can be scientifically challenged, but people do it. There's no you know, name calling or anything. It's just a good group of people. It's very high level, though. I recommend people kind of lurk and, you know what I mean, to kind of read it and follow it. It'll take you back about 2 years and
thousands
and thousands of pages.
Yep. It's kind of an acquired taste. If you don't really want high level calculus, you might want to just read and not try to comment. But mm-hmm. Look. What did those folks say when you showed them your first results?
They were quite excited that they finally had something outside of, because they've been dealing with what, it all started with what Scheuer said that he did. And he actually started making these claims about electromagnetic drive as early as the late 90s. And then along about 2006 is when it really hit the so this gentleman has been working on it for quite a few years, and then in 2006 it started gaining some traction, mainly in the UK press, and then it got to the point where NASA became interested, and then they started trying to replicate what Scheuer was doing, and Scheuer had sent a model over to Boeing, and they quickly clammed up and didn't talk about it. And then
I wonder why.
The Northwest Polytechnic Institute in China, Northwest China, they claimed that they were able to duplicate what Scheuer was doing, and that was, I think, in 2012, 2013, and they clammed up ever since they presented the information. So, and then the last one that we had, the other institution that is from Dresden. It's a technical college in Dresden, Germany, and they have claimed that Dr. Tajmar cannot rule out a thrust. He's tried to look. Something's happening. He's kind of getting into the same situation that I'm in right now. Is he's looking at it in a much finer tooth comb. Of course, he's looking at it in a vacuum too, but he's got the resources that can look at it a lot faster. And in more detail than what I can. So him and I are on the same path. He may get there before I do, obviously, with the full lab backing. But we're sort of in the same position. Something weird is going on. I'm looking at it closer.
Well, if you approach your friends at NASA Lewis, now called Glenn, you know, after John Glenn, mm-hmm. and they don't say, oh, my God, they bring that over here and let's, you know, if they don't respond enthusiastically, we might be able to help there.
That would be great. I could come back, and that's probably, I'm going to say, I would be in that particular stage. My guess would be in November is just a kind of a long look out into the future about when I would be ready to go to that particular phase, if everything progressed as I think it is. So sometime, pardon me, either before Thanksgiving or maybe right after, I would be ready to talk about whether or not they were able to get me in or not.
So,
and of course, they may say that it takes 2 years to get in. So
okay, so let's assume that it's on a fast track, because I was invited actually to do some experiments with Bruce De Palma at the zero gravity drop facility there at NASA Lewis.
Cool.
We were gonna test some very curious phenomenon, which happened in space when you rotate things and process them. And they've got, I think, something like 5 or 6 seconds of zero gravity when they release the sled at the top and before it hits the cushioning at the bottom. Mm-hmm. So you can actually do zero gravity experiments for, I guess, 3 to 5 seconds, I think. I remember that number right. So they appeared to be, of the all the NASA people that I interacted with back in those years, the kind of most open member. The Lewis, now Glenn, was the place where the director invited me to do a major Sidonia Mars presentation on what we found on Mars, and then invited me back to do another one. So they're kind of open. If you get, if your friends are really your friends and you get in there, something remarkable could happen. So in 4 weeks from around Thanksgiving, we could have day one hell of a Christmas present.
Wouldn't that be nice where they say, I'll open the vacuum and or bring it in and let's go. That would be fantastic. I do think I'm going to have to do an awful lot of validation. There's, you know, because that chamber, some, they told me it takes like half a day. I saw somewhere that to evacuate, because it's a huge vacuum chamber.
When you say huge, how huge is huge?
You're talking airplane hangar size.
Oh!
It's a huge, I'm going to guess it's I'm just taking a stab at it because I saw the videos and a few still pictures on it. But it's something that that you could put, you know, several buses in.
Now, do you need a vacuum chamber that big to avoid things like wall effects or whatever, or could a much smaller chamber suffice?
You know, the small chambers that I saw them testing with at NASA Eagle Works, I thought were too small. And in fact, I was wondering why the Johnson Space Center people didn't go up to Cleveland and use something that was so big that there wouldn't be any wall, because wall interactions are yes, exactly.
Well, as I understand it, excuse me, from reading, you know, those voluminous pages, and it's really a read, and I haven't had time since I started the show to actually go over and take a look. They required, the Cleveland folks there at NASA Glenn require a minimum level of thrust to be able to detect. I don't understand the details, because if you're doing mm-hmm. it on a tabletop with a laser pointer and getting something that looks interesting, the fact that NASA can't measure fine levels of thrust in a vacuum, I find a little bit unusual, but let's assume mm-hmm. that they're right. Do you know whether your level of thrust qualifies for their level of measurement?
Yes, I think it would. The NASA has tested... but not here at Cleveland, but down at the Johnson Space Center, they have tested two other, possibly three other systems. I think the total test of three systems. Shower was one of them. Then another one from Guido Fetta, who has Kinney. Drive has a little bit of a different design, but it's basically the same concept. And then they tested their own. They were able to do, with some laser interferometry, they're able to do some pretty high resolution measurements. What Cleveland has up here, I'm a little bit surprised too, because they can certainly use laser interferometry, which is much better than the laser displacement sensors that I'm using. So,
well, you see,
I guess I'd have to look into that a little bit more. I don't know why they said it's just a minimum amount. So
I'm kind of wondering if that's part of the delaying tactic. Because, and again, this is not you, this is me. But as I read all those pages, I almost got the feeling that the Eagle Works crew were doing something at a level where everything they did was inefficient, almost as if they didn't want to see it work, and it worked in spite of what they were doing. And the whole excuse, the reason they couldn't take it to Glenn, was because, frankly, somebody in NASA or somebody's doesn't want them to.
Well, if you stop and think about how much they have invested in propellant technology, how many future programs, how many future projects, how many vendors, how many, you know, just go down the list. They are in an industry with people like Lockheed and Grumman and Boeing and everybody else that's in this propulsion, this huge, monstrous industry. And I think we talked about that last time. The propulsion industry is major, major players in both the private and military and public arenas with propulsion. But look at the money they're making with their existing technology. Lots of money. So there's lots of money at stake in this.
Hang on. If this works, if it can be proven it works, it changes everything, and there's a fortune. There are trillions and trillions of dollars and 1,000 Elon Musks and, you know, people who aren't even born yet who will be, you know, living the life of luxury depending upon how we democratize and industrialize the solar system where there's nobody and there's nothing to pollute because the sun does a very good job of that all by itself. So why wouldn't they allocate sufficient resources up front to find out if it works, and then they let the contracts and industry moves in and does what industry does best, which is to make things big?
Mm-hmm. I think you answered it. The creation of the thousands and thousands and thousands of Elon Musks that take it out of their realm and their sphere of influence. For example, if I'm on a very, very small scale, if I'm able to do something like this in my garage lab, and another person of the next city over was able to do it a little bit better, the next city over, another person able to do it a little bit better, this is technology that's getting a little bit out of what you might call control. And if everybody is able to do something and to progress this, they don't have the... They don't have all the answers, nor do they have all the control. They may not be able to react fast enough. You know, big companies are very, very hard to get them to steer. Look at it as a big luxury liner that is chugging away, making good profits, you know, thousands and thousands of employees, and they all of a sudden want to make a right turn to investigate new technology. Well, it takes a while to turn that ship, and there's a lot of entrepreneurs. I'm not interested in it from a business standpoint, creating a company, but there are a lot of people out there, probably in your audience, that would be. So what I'm doing right now might help them down the road, because I, like you said, I publish everything I'm doing, and I do the videos and publish all the data so everybody can see it. And I think that can be somewhat of a threat to people. Maybe an example of that. Here's a good example. When Shower sent the unit to Boeing, it was quickly taken in and kept under wraps, to where the only thing Boeing would comment on afterwards is Phantom Works is no longer working with Mr. Scheuer. That doesn't say much.
One can interpret that several ways.
You can interpret it several different ways, right. And so that was quickly taken in. Of course, there's been, over the years, there's been, well, I don't know if we talked about this last time or not, when the tire and rubber companies and the gasoline companies and the car companies got together and bought all the interurban trail. Interurban transit system back in the 30s.
Mm.
You know, the interurban was a light rail line that was used to go from the suburbs in a lot of cities and towns.
Didn't LA used to have this kind of a system, and then it was all torn out when the interstate highway system was built?
It was bought. It was bought by the interurban systems were bought out by a consortium of companies. Firestone was one of them, one of the major oil companies, one of the major car manufacturers. And there was lawsuits and everything else that occurred because it was a collusion type of thing. But basically, they bought them out, and that's why we don't have light rail systems like they do in Europe, because that wasn't in the interest of the tire and rubber companies, and the oil companies, and the car companies. Mm-hmm. They were quite happy with the way things were progressing with their technology and their products. And light rail, the interurban system, was a system that they just didn't think should be around anymore. So they bought all most of the track up in the United States, and they burnt the cars. There's a pretty good article on that on Wikipedia, and that leads you to a lot of different links. But INTERURBAN, and then you can look for lawsuits, and it'll tell you all about it. It's pretty interesting. But you know, these big companies, when they get together, they represent trillions of dollars. And if they don't want to do something, and they all decide they don't want to go in a certain direction, they won't. It'll be up to people like Elon Musk, who is much, much higher level and accomplished than I am, obviously, to come up with an electric car company. And
well, you know what's so cool? If we could crowdsource your funding to develop your technology to where it was, yes, it's really there, the next step is we can take it to Musk. We happen to have connections to Elon Musk. Musk is going to be on this show. I'm not sure exactly when, but that has been in the works now for a few months. And toward the end of the year, Christmas, you know, sounds like Tuesday for the Enterprise. We could maybe have him on the show. We could bring him on with you. We could show him on this show, radio with pictures, video of your demo, and get him to commit nothing of his resources, nothing, to test it out in his facilities with his engineers, with his control, so that we find out how we can take it to the next level. There's nothing that prevents us from doing a workaround to the blocks and the control systems, which frankly seem designed to keep us on this planet.
That's correct. Where nice, tidy profit is being made, and don't rock the boat. And I believe he has the technology now that takes it into low Earth orbit and beyond. So it wouldn't be that you would have to go to a NASA or to ESA or to any of the other launch people. You get this thing into space, and let's just see if this thing works. Get it out of low, give it a little slight push. Put a transponder on it, light the thing up with solar panels, and see how far and fast this thing can get. So, yeah, that would be quite cool.
Amazing. Hold it there. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Dave Distler. When we come back from the break, we're going to open the lines so you can ask Dave how you can go to the stars. Stay tuned. Morning once again. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Dave Distler, and we're tracking a revolution that you can actually help create. Dave, please give out your website again. Tell us how we can help you with minimal funding. I mean, at the level of spaceflight and NASA and aerospace companies, this is nothing. This is, you know, coffee money, as I keep saying. But it can be the critical coffee money at the critical time. So please give out your website again, and then we have them stacked up to where they want to talk to us. So we will open the lines, and we will proceed. Turn down your device. Please turn down your devices. Do not be on the air. Hello?
It's down. Hey, what's up?
Oh, you're totally over-modulating. Totally.
Okay, is
so
this back, better?
No, there's quieter. Back up. Okay.
I'm pretty far back.
That's fine. Great. Now hold it there while Dave gives us that website again.
Okay. And I'd like to thank Daniel, because it looks like Daniel got a note that he contributed to it. But thanks, Daniel. It's www.paypal.me/nsf 1701. PayPal.me/NSF1701.
Okay, caller, give us your name, where you're calling from, and what do you want to ask Dave?
1701, that's pretty cool.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, that is cool. This is Torch.
Oh, Torch. Good old Torch.
How are you? Yeah, how you been?
Doing pretty well. So what do you want to know from Dave?
Yeah, I was just curious. Do you guys, you know there's a secret space program, right?
Yeah, of course.
All right. Don't you think that maybe they have technology that's so far more advanced than this stuff?
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. It's locked up. We can't get to it. If this works, we can do the ultimate workaround. We can save the damn planet if we simply demonstrate this works.
Oh, that definitely works.
Well, we don't know. Science is experiment and proof. We need proof. Dave is very close. What he described tonight in these reactions, I mean, Dave, give us a kind of a calibration. You said earlier that you felt it was 50-50 that you're getting something real.
Yes, I think it's about maybe a little better than 50-50 that there's how you doing, Torch, by the way? Thanks for calling. Yeah, I do feel that there's something out there, and I've heard of the secret space program, but I've heard the rumors, and I guess I'm one of those type of people that I have got to see it for myself. I've also, and if I can't see it for myself, if it is kept secret to that particular level, then I've got to go start experimenting around with maybe some of the technology. Now, could it be that this technology actually came to shower somehow? Bump into somebody that spilt some of the beans about what they were doing. You know, it's all very possible that that the guy who first thought about this thing might have run across this somewhere because he did work for a military contractor.
You know, I never thought of that. His story is that he was working with communication satellites, and, of course, communication satellites have ordinary thrusters and rockets for, you know, changing orbits, station keeping, rotation to keep the spot beams focused on the Earth, etc. He says that the microwave antenna systems on those spacecraft produced anomalies that got him looking at how there could be thrust when there was nothing that was supposed to be thrusting on these communication satellites. But that could be, as you just pointed out, a very elegant cover story to hide the fact that somebody in a back room said, "Psst, hey, come over here, Roger. I got something to really show you. If you're interested in space flight, wait till you see this."
I think that's the case. That's probably the likelihood. If in fact that happened, if in fact they do have this technology, that is probably how it would leak out. It wouldn't be that someone would say, "Here's a blueprint for you. Go build it." It would be what someone called one time breadcrumbs. So some breadcrumbs will be put out there, maybe inadvertently too. You know, maybe what he did see, maybe he was in charge of one portion of the satellite, let's say, and he started seeing the satellite do some strange things. Well, the satellite's never been identified, never been discussed what it did or what its purpose was. So I'm assuming that it was a covert satellite of some sort, but it was doing some things it shouldn't have been doing. And
well, maybe what happened is, given it's a military satellite, if it was for tactical theater war operations where you would need very high power from the spacecraft to reach a handheld receiver on the ground with high bandwidth, maybe the power levels on that communication satellite in terms of the microwave beams was enough to tip it over to where they actually saw thrust effects that are masked normally by the noise, by, you know, solar wind, by upper atmospheric drag, by, you know, all that stuff.
That's correct. But yeah, you're right. Most of the satellites operate on very small amounts of power, but, you know, some of the satellites they don't talk about, especially with some of the ground penetrating radar that they have been throwing around over the desert regions in in Africa to see the buried cities and so forth. That's some pretty high power microwave radar signals that that maybe one of those things that came along and said, well, why is this satellite drifting so far, or why is it pushing away, or why is it
I remember years ago Van Flandern, who was involved with the U.S. Naval Observatory before he tragically died much too soon. He'd be having so much fun with us now. Van Flandern told me once that he was tracking certain satellites in orbit, and he saw anomalous, what he called celestial mechanics effects. In other words, their orbits were changing, but in ways that no model had predicted, and he was able to track it down to eclipse effects. Now, he died before he could get the results of our eclipse measurements with the Accutron technology in terms of the unusual inertial properties of aligning celestial bodies, the inertial mass of objects, particularly objects that are moving in motion, change. So I'm thinking that, yes, there very well could have been an unexplained effect above a certain power level that only the black ops guys would have noticed, and one of them could have communicated to Shire, and then the rest is history. But you see, all that history we don't have to worry about. We've got your experiment to work with. Now, let me tell you an update. Scotty, good old Scotty down in engineering, has actually been able to get up on the site the PayPal link that you gave out before, www.paypal.me/NSF1701, good old 1701. So if you go to your page tonight on othersideofmidnight.com, scroll down to the bottom of your bio, there's the link. There the link will be forever and ever. If you need funding, folks, go and please help Roger to prove we're not confined to this one planet much longer.
That is great. Fantastic. I will have to take a look at... in fact, I just had my page up there a second ago, and I'll refresh it. And you guys are pretty quick and on the ball with that sort of thing. I have to admit, you guys pretend like you've been on this digital social media for years. Well, you probably have.
Hey, the revolution will be digitized.
Yes, it will.
Torch, anything else?
All I can see is all these microwaves being cannibalized out there.
Cannibalized.
Yes, carefully. That's Torch, that's one thing. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, is if you go out there and you mess with it, you could be just even opening the thing. There are these, they look innocuous. They don't look like they're going to cause you any trouble, but it's a big capacitor. It's usually sitting on the back.
How many volts?
And that thing sits at 4,000 volts.
Oh, good grief.
And for example, if you plug this thing in and you let it sit there for a while, and within about a minute or two you unplugged it, took the case off, and put your hand across that capacitor, you'd be zapped with 4,000 volts. So hopefully they won't cannibalize it without at least going to a mentor or, you know, a professor or a... maybe a ham radio friend or something like that. Say, hey, you know, I've been hearing about this thing. What's that all about? And then maybe that gets people into conversations. And, you know, as long as you know what high voltage can do, it's no problem. You just have to know the potential for it. It can bite you bad, Torch.
Right, right. Hey, and one last thing. Check out, have you ever...
Back up a little. You're over-modulating.
Sorry. TR3B Astra.
I've heard of that, and I can't. TR3B isn't that one of the
Aurora project?
Yeah, isn't that one of the projects that go beyond it's Spaceplane Project, correct?
Yeah, they've been flying that thing since the early '80s.
Really?
You can actually see it on YouTube. Just punch in TR-3B Astra.
We've
got to get you a better phone, Torch. I'm sorry, I'm going to let you go because it's really bad quality. So,
sorry about that.
No problem. You can do better next time.
I'll work on it.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Take care.
Okay, let's go on to our next call because we don't have a lot of time left, and I know there's a million questions out there. Who are you? You're on the air. Give us your name and where you're calling from, and please turn down your device.
Ed in Reading, Pennsylvania.
Oh, great audio, Ed. Thank you.
Okay. About 5 days ago, there was another David on the other show right before you, and that was Professor David Perry's.
That was Ark show. That was Saturday morning, I think.
Okay, how come you didn't mention that? Because they also mentioned that not only are they getting a space warp, but NASA's getting a space warp bubble also.
Well, because we don't know. Dave, you want to go into why this whole warp idea kind of snowballed out there and isn't really backed by good science yet?
Right. And I believe that was David Ferris, and I believe he is in the middle of the country somewhere that's doing...
Colorado, I think.
Yeah. I think he's doing an experiment. It's not a cavity. It's some sort of electromagnetic, but it's not a cavity type of thing. And I've seen some of his videos, and I've seen his presentations, and he's got some very interesting... proposition, another citizen scientist out there, I think, who's trying to prove or disprove. But what Richard was talking about earlier was the fact that the part of the theory that one of the scientists at the Johnson Space Center had proposed was that this was warping space, that this was somehow condensing or compressing or expanding space-time near the device. Well, all they needed to do was to say warp, and the first thing that the press picked up on is Star Trek, and then they said NASA has developed
warp drive.
And
which is the quickest way to kill this at the higher levels of NASA.
Yeah,
and in fact, it did. That's when Paul March, I believe, who was coming on the NASA Spaceflight Forum regularly and reporting their progress, he had to clam up. They literally told him, you talk to those folks, you get fired. So the lid came down because of the press overreaction to the idea of a warped space-time around the EM drive when it is functioning.
Yeah, because the theory hasn't been there. No one's put the math down on the piece of paper to say that it is warping space. Now, it seems to make sense, but the term is so iconic in our mind because of the entertainment industry that you're thinking, oh, we can go warp factor 2 now. Okay, we can build the Starship Enterprise and we can get to Alpha Centauri in a matter of minutes. So there was a lot of positive. I mean, the general press paid a lot of attention to it, but what they reported, since they're not as trained in science as a lot of us are, is they just put it out there. And for the average reader who said, NASA has warp drive, well, we'll have the Starship Enterprise. It just happened way too fast. There should have been a little more information about really it was a theory that there's a small amount of space-time warp that's near this device and is either being pulled or pushed. But that didn't happen. It was just thrown out there, and boom! It blew up well more than it should have. And you're right, Richard. That's why they clamped down on any more discussions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call.
Okay. Our number, by the way, if you don't remember the number, it's 505-796-8802. If you're on Skype, Enterprise Mission is the handle. So give us a call. We've got a few minutes left. What kind of instrumentation do you have, and are you doing this, let me do a parenthetical, are you doing this in your kitchen or garage?
It is, no. It definitely is outside the house. It's in. Yeah, I have...
Because my next question was, if it's in the kitchen, how long are you going to be married?
Not very long. I would have been divorced by now, as a matter of fact. But I actually, we were joking about that, and... I told my wife, I said, I love my animals, obviously, but I told her, I said, you know, if this this machine didn't actually provide thrust, it might be able to repel like mice and rodents and things from around the house because we live in the woods.
Mm.
I said I still might be able to use this for something. I mean, she didn't find the humor in that
did
at all.
Did not find that very fun. Okay, that leads me to my serious question, which is, do you have the instrumentation to measure leakage from your frustum?
Yes, I do. And that's measured in milliwatts per centimeter. I have got actually, it turned out to be a microwave oven leakage safety meter, and I could measure it digitally. It wasn't that expensive. The alarms do go off, and you can see when there is leakage around it. It's interesting. It pulses. It's like it builds up energy, and then boom, it goes off, and then it goes away. It's a very ghost-like.
That's weird.
It is very weird. It's a ghost-like response with
thing. That right there says there's some unusual physics going on.
There is something unusual because no one's put together this shape of this configuration for anything else. It doesn't seem like this shape and size makes any sense for anything.
Well, actually, it does. See, this is what's so cool, and we've got about 7 minutes left, so let me get into the cool part. Did you ever think of the comparison between the shape? Just think in terms of straight geometry. Remember, that's what we do here is geometry. A cutoff cone or a funnel, really, if you look at it from the side, what does it look like? Just look at it from the side and turn it upside down so the small end is facing up.
I've looked at that, and I've thought about that many times. And you know, if you open your wallet, take out a dollar bill, look at the back of it, it looks like a pyramid.
It looks like a pyramid. Now, we have measured, literally around the world, Robin and I have gone and taken this Accutron technology, which is measuring literally tremors in the force. It's measuring inertial changes in the vibration of the tuning fork. We're measuring actual sensory input from a pyramidal massive stone structure various places in the world. That shape, that very shape, according to literature that I have been looking at, indicates that there's something going on between matter and energy as we defined it, EM radiation, and the ether and the torsion field. That very shape defines that interaction as being nonlinear. So if you now translate that idea into a cone-shaped contained space where you inject microwaves, the very shape itself may be conducive to the unusual nonlinear interaction between the electromagnetic radiation bouncing around inside this cone and the field and the torsion field surrounding it and us and the Earth and the system and the universe. And literally, it's kind of like dragging yourself around by your bootstraps, because you're hooking in almost like a canoe rowing across a pond, a mechanism of getting leverage in the ether and pulling the device along.
Very, very, as a sacred, you know, the sacred shapes of the pyramids have always been a fascinating topic for me, and especially the chambers in the Great Pyramid in Giza. Who knows? I mean, I'm going to have to listen to some of your archives to learn more about your experiments with that. But it definitely, you know, you do a slice cross section, it looks like the shape of a pyramid, no doubt about it.
See, the cool thing is, we could set up your radiation detector, and caller, I'm going to get to you. Don't go away. All right, this is a conversation, and I like to involve people in a conversation. If we could set up the Accutron and your radio RF noise detector side by side, so we know when the pulses are escaping your frustum, we could then look at the waveforms and we could look at the measurements again in between, and that would give us pure inertial results, and that would give us a possible means of measuring the actual bending or change in the properties of space-time around the engine sitting in your garage.
I'd love to be able to to test that because it's both visual and audio. When it goes into the leakage mode, or the warning mode, let's put it that way, it's LED flashes and a audible alarm goes off, so that'd be easy to link up.
Have you tested this in the dark so you can see if there's any lightning or fluorescence or anything?
There is actually, I have done that on the beryllium oxide, the ceramic. I got to avoid getting too technical, but on the ceramic itself, it actually glows. I was really surprised to see that.
Can you pick this up with your video?
No, I didn't. As a matter of fact, that's one thing I didn't do that I wanted to do is to videotape the magnetron radome or the antenna. really start glowing. I did not expect to see any light there whatsoever, and I just caught it out of the corner of my eye because obviously I'm leaving the area and staying away from, you know, near field exposure to the radiation. But I did catch a glimpse of it, and I will promise between now and November to actually take a video of that.
Excellent. Okay, caller, it's time. Your name and where you're calling from.
This is Kevin, Colorado Springs.
Hi, Kevin.
And I've got a quick question for you. I get that you can go to Pluto, but how would this EM drive handle reentry? Do you still have the same problem of heat upon reentry?
Dave, you want to take that?
Sure. Yes. Thanks for the call. It is, it's the same as any rocket, except that it's at constant velocity. So if you look at it, here's what you would do. If you halfway, let's say you were wanting to get to Pluto, halfway there, you reversed the engine and you started decelerating. So half of the trip would be getting up to speed. The other half would be slowing down. You could slow down to theoretically a stop right in the atmosphere of Pluto, which has a real thin atmosphere, and you could land the thing. So what's neat about this is that half the trip there is thrust in one direction that's accelerating up to a speed. You twist it around 180 degrees. It's slowing itself down to the point where it could stop in space if you wanted to or land on the planet.
So when you collide back with Earth's atmosphere, because we've all seen either the Apollo or space shuttle, even a tremendous amount of heat.
Oh, but that's because, hang on, Kevin, that's because you're re-entering at 17,500 miles an hour.
Right.
What Dave is saying, hang on, what Dave is saying is if you, you know, send a spacecraft to Pluto, you land it, you have a little rover on it, again, this is all modularized. You get pictures, you get samples, you put them back in your spacecraft, you lift off, you accelerate halfway home, you then turn around, you decelerate into Earth orbit. You can actually decelerate to zero relative to the atmosphere, and you basically can glide home on wings or a parachute from the atmosphere with no heating.
Right, and that's what I was wondering, is if that was actually possible, because we've all kind of been conditioned to expect that there's got to be some sort of friction upon reentry.
That's all conditioning. There doesn't have to be. That's a big 10-4.
Yeah, well, good good call, Kevin. Yeah, that's a good point, because we're thinking about using up propellant and going so fast. You use up propellant, you're shot in one direction, you're a rifle bullet. You're shot in one direction. You can't twist that aircraft, that spacecraft around. You don't have enough propellant left to slow it down to a dead stop. So we're conditioned to something re-entering the atmosphere of the Earth at very, very high speeds. Of course, you have to be at high speeds to maintain orbit, but with a propellantless type system, many, many more times powerful than what we're talking about here, technically you could bring it to a dead stop. You could just let it glide straight down and land on a dry desert location. So
years and years ago, a friend of mine named G. Harry Stein, who wrote science fiction under the pen name Lee Corey, basically wrote a story describing you, Dave. Except,
uh-oh.
Yeah, because this is a private guy, private engineer, got intrigued with some things that didn't make sense. He winds up building a device like an M drive in his garage. And then he says to himself, well, where can I use this? And because he's a pilot, my friend G. Harry Stein was a pilot, and he almost killed me over the Grand Canyon one day, and we'll talk about that another time. He, in the story, has his engineer put this drive in a Piper Cub, and he takes it up into the upper atmosphere. He has oxygen. He literally takes his space drive into space in a Piper Cub. And that's the end of our show, because there's our music. I want to thank my guest tonight, Dave Dissler, Mr. Revolution. Dave, we're going to monitor this very, very carefully. I hope people subscribe and send you enough money to get to the next step, because this could be one heck of a Christmas present. So until tomorrow morning, this is your host, Richard C. Hoagland, saying with special meaning this time, third star on the left, straight ahead. till morning.